Welcome back, everyone, to the Renew Democracy Initiative's Winter is Here. Obviously, we've been on hiatus for a while, but we're bringing this back for a special episode to discuss unfolding events in Russia and what they mean for the war and the world. And joining me today is my co-host, former world chess champion, RDI chairman, and persistent thorn in the side of dictators everywhere, Garry Kasparov. Thanks for joining, Garry.
Yes, it's great to be here. Just one correction. You said episode. I think we are talking about episodes. It's plural.
Yes, I think we're probably going to have to do a few of these. Obviously, what we're seeing here is unfolding in real time. You know, we're recording this right now at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time on Saturday, June 24th. And needless to say, within 12 hours, there could be a battle south of Moscow. And, you know, we don't know exactly right now how that battle will unfold.
No. Actually, it's the battle near Moscow can start in 3 or 4 hours because the Wagner troops now are just about 300 kilometers away from Moscow and they're advancing very quickly. So that's the latest. What remains to be seen, if there will be any resistance at all, even considering the numerical advantage of, let's call them pro-Putin forces, pro-government forces. I'm not sure that they will have guts to take on Wagner because as of now, we speak now at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time, there was no resistance at all.
Yeah, he took over an entire military administration in Rostov without a single bullet being fired.
Yeah, which again is to be expected. It's easy to say to be expected when it has happened, but we could see the signs of this rebellion being seeded or just, you know, like writings on the wall because Prigozhin felt comfortable attacking Russian military leadership with no consequences. But also, you know, from the first day of Putin's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, 2022, we talked about lessons from Russian history. Unfortunately, many ignored the lessons of history. I think it's this some sort of contempt. History is not mathematics. It's not, you know, as simple as 2 plus 2. The interesting thing is that, yes, it's not as straight as in mathematics. There's no formula. But you know what? You know, it's always, you know, ends up with the right number. When it's 2 plus 2, 3 plus 1, 5 minus 1, but somehow history just ends up with the same answer.
I like that.
Huh. Yeah. And we talked, and actually I have to confess that even I, you know, made this slight, you know, mistake in evaluating events of the past. We talked about Russia's lost wars, first Crimean War in the middle of 19th century that led to the abolition of serfdom in Russia, the Russo-Japanese War that led to the revolt and turned revolution that ended up with Russia being transformed into constitutional monarchy. We briefly mentioned World War I and moved to the Afghan War, the collapse of Soviet Union, followed the disastrous war in Afghanistan and subsequent loss of Russian Soviet empire in Eastern Europe. The World War I was somehow hanging in the air because it was not lost. And we said, oh, it didn't go well. Actually, what's happening now, it's an exact replica, as much as you can compare events in parallel, historical events, with World War I. And it's a triumph of Dr. Freud that Putin even mentioned 1917. And he's absolutely right. What we're seeing now, again, as exact as one can imagine, the replica of 1917, because we're not talking about war that being lost. We're talking about a war that is not going well. And also the war that has no meaning for most of people that have been recruited. What we are fighting for. And also it's a war that is happening at a time where the social and wealth disparity in Russia, it's worse than in many African countries. And as we know, Putin was smart, or his advisors, not to recruit people from Moscow, St. Petersburg, mostly taking mobilized soldiers from very depressed regions or national republics, which means that the social status of soldiers that have been recruited and fought in Ukraine, and many of them died in Ukraine, and we're talking about probably over 200,000 dead and God knows how many wounded on the Russian side as of today, and they saw nothing but social injustice. They're fighting the war. They pay little, and bureaucrats can't even withhold the payments for the wounded or for dead. They have been suffering from pressure from local police and local bureaucrats. It's just all of a sudden, they've got weapons. And they've got someone, in this case, Prigozhin, who said, you know, guys, the war was not, you know, of our making. By the way, it's interesting. that Prigozhin totally refuted. Elon Musk, David Sachs, Jeffrey Sachs. I mean, all these, you know, American, you know, tankies or right wingers, you know, who talked about, you know, oh, Putin, you know, was right. He did this and it's native. I mean, Prigozhin said, okay, nonsense, you know, forget about it, BS. There was no reason for us to start this war. It was an absolute bogus reason invented by regime.
I absolutely love the fact that Prigozhin ended up being more critical of Kremlin talking points than both David Sachs on the one hand and Jeffrey Sachs on the other. I think that it's just incredibly critical.
Prigozhin knows exactly. Prigozhin is, well, let's make it very clear. Prigozhin is a war criminal. And he actually was a criminal, a true criminal, even in the Soviet Union. Mm. I mean, he's just, you know, he is a criminal, period. And it's not just, you know, for petty theft. I mean, it's for serious crimes. So Prigozhin is just, you know, he's a bandit. But again, the guy definitely has, you know, organizational capacities. He rose quite quickly, you know, in among Putin's rank and files. He built this organization that, you know, found these gold mines in Africa. Actually, gold mines is figuratively because it's gold, it's uranium, it's everything, diamonds. And he built the most effective military force in Russia. And after many of the elite Russian troops have been decimated in the beginning of this full-fledged invasion, so Prigozhin is now probably in charge of the most capable elements of Russian army. But again, that's going back to 1917. The war is going nowhere. And whether we like it or not, we can remember Lenin. Let's turn imperialistic war into civil war. Mm. And again, this was a classical imperialist war. Again, that had nothing to do with the majority of the soldiers, almost all of them that had been recruited. And the fact is that Putin failed to take over Kyiv in 3 days and the war went forever. It created a very great rising tension in the society. And one thing that made the situation even worse for the regime that in 1917, actually not one, a few reasons, but one of them is, yes, Tsar and the bureaucrats in Russia, the elite aristocracy, the industrialists, they lived in luxury. But the peasants who were mobilized for Russian army from Tomsk region or from Penza region, they had no idea. Or maybe they had an idea, but they'd never seen it. Today, every recruit probably has a mobile phone. And even if he didn't watch Navalny's movies, I mean, he definitely knows. I mean, he watches, you know, on social media. This despicable luxury, the decadent luxury of Putin's cronies. And he knows that their sons are not fighting on the front line. This unknown Russian soldier, he's pissed off because he's facing uncertainty. He can die. His family will be left with no real money. Even if he comes back, God forbid, wounded, he will be still a subject of humiliation by local police or local bureaucrats because that's the way mafia works. And now he has a chance. Somebody tells him, let's restore justice. Let's, you know, take back what is ours. And that's an easy call. And also there's one more thing compared to 1917. There is no political infrastructure in Russia as it existed in 1917 because it was constitutional monarchy. Yeah, parliament had little power, but there was a parliament there. There were political parties. Putin totally destroyed any sign of independent political activity in Russia. It's like political desert. And if it's a hot desert for many years, you know, what kind of creatures can survive there? Snakes, scorpions, rats. Yes, they did. And they basically take over control of this desert because that's the only creatures that can sustain this political climate. And what Prigozhin's rebellion already now has proven that every element of Putin's mafia state was a decoration. It's like a Hollywood decoration. You have a nice picture, nothing behind it. Parliament, Senate, government. Have you seen these people? Where is Volodya, the Speaker of Duma? Where is Matvienko, the chairwoman of the Senate? Where is Mishustin, the Prime Minister? They've gone. You haven't heard from them. Where are all these, you know, the propaganda gurus? They've all gone, disappeared. So it just shows that the whole system was built on a fear and kind of a credit of trust to Putin because nobody dared to take on him. And again, now the time to ask question that has been used about the argument that has been used against me for years. Anytime I talked about Putin regime being built on the sand, the answer was, but Putin is so popular. Mm. Now my question, is he popular? How come that he cannot find, you know, the loyal forces, at least as of now, at the moment we speak, to defend against a few thousand of Prigozhin soldiers, maybe 10,000. Definitely Prigozhin is moving to Moscow with a small contingent, relatively small contingent. But the difference is that Prigozhin is bringing with him troops that fought in Ukraine. Those who fought under Bakhmut or Solidar, And these people, you know, they're seasoned warriors. They face death dozens of times. I'm not, you know, trying to excuse their crimes. They're definitely on the wrong side, but they're tough. They're killing machines, and they're not afraid to die. And who is opposing them? People were trained to go after unarmed protesters. And now when they have to take on army of berserkers, you know, this is the very determined Prigozhin fighters, and also many ordinary Russian soldiers and officers who decided not to follow their generals. Because again, what for? So we could see that so many Russian brigades now already changing sides. Because for them, Prigozhin is someone who symbolizes the restoration of social justice. Important to understand, people who are joining Prigozhin, they were traditionally Putin's base. Putin always appealed to this base, you know, against the so-called pro-Western liberals. Mm-hmm. And irony is that this base now is demanding for him to pay because, look, he offered them nothing. They felt cheated. And they could see this despicable luxury of Putin's cronies. And they will follow anyone, you know, any leader who can promise them that the justice will be restored.
What's absolutely incredible here is Prigozhin has finally shown that the emperor has no clothes, right?
Yep.
Something that Western elites for years have refused to believe. I mean, how many times have you, has RDI, have other folks in our network heard that, oh, well, you know, we can't go any further. Putin is too strong, too powerful, too this, too that.
Too popular.
Too popular.
Yes,
and
yes.
And that we have to kowtow to Russia, that we have to back off. We have to compromise. We have to negotiate. We have to do all of these things, give Putin the trappings of power, and therefore allow him to sort of continue to develop this Potemkin village that was the Russian political elite. And finally, it took a war criminal, a warlord, a Russian warlord to bring that kind of
screeching to a halt. Let's say the warlord rose against Putin after Russian army had been many times defeated in Ukraine.
That's right.
It's the Ukrainian heroism and political leadership of Zelensky
yes.
and his team that proved that Russian army was not the second army in the world, and the corruption, you know, played the same role of diminishing the military capacity of Russian armies the same way it did for Russian economy. So Ukrainian performance, outstanding performance in the war, led to the growing frustration among Russian populace. And also, I think Prigozhin was the first one to realize this war was not winnable.
Yeah.
And I believe that Prigozhin has been preparing for this uprising for quite a while. And what triggered this uprising is that Shoigu, the Minister of Defense, decision to force his hand, because that's the way the generals think, they are also bureaucrats, took full control of Wagner and other paramilitary forces, because according to Shoigu's decree, since July 1st this year, all the groups had to be under the direct command of Minister of Defense, which basically meant, you know, a warrant for Prigozhin. I mean, he knew that on July 2nd, he would be sent with his people to back to Bakhmut, to the front line, to die there. So he had no choice but to fight, either to escape to Africa, but I think he made a good call, recognizing that many of the Russian brigades that fought in Ukraine, they would take his side because they saw this injustice and they also recognized this war is not winnable. And why are we fighting there? Because we want decent life. And we could see these fat cats in Moscow, in Rublevka, you know, the famous road with duchess and with palaces, actually, you know, of Putin, new Putin's aristocracy. And I think that's Prigozhin's aim. I think that if Prigozhin takes over Moscow, we'll see some looting.
Yeah, the situation right now is just, it's absolutely incredible to me. And to your point, I mean, if not for the Ukrainians, I mean, really, you were right to highlight that it wasn't so much that Prigozhin showed that the emperor had no clothes. It was the bravery of the Ukrainians that showed that and that kind of put him in that position to then march on Moscow. But it was the fact that the Ukrainians continued to humiliate the Russian military after people like Samuel Chirap at the RAND Corporation and countless others said that Kyiv would fall within days and used that as an argument for the West to not help Ukraine, to not give them anything of what they needed because, well, they're just going to lose anyway. So, you know, we don't need to think about that. And now the fact that Ukrainians refused to lose, the fact that they proved all of these quote-unquote experts wrong is going to fundamentally, I think, change the nature of global authoritarianism. Because if Putinism falls, that's just the first domino, right? I mean, one of the key arguments of RDI is that all of these authoritarians are linked. And Putin cannot fall without then threatening the survival of Maduro in Venezuela, of the dictator in Zimbabwe, and so on and so forth. I mean, the downstream effects of this, you know, I don't know a better word for it than civil war in Russia, and, you know, the impact of Ukrainian civil society is going to be huge.
Yeah, you know, I think I would be very cautious using the term civil war, because civil war means that you have civil population engaged in fighting. As of today in Russia, we could say maybe my country is on the verge of civil war, but still it's between armed forces, armed groups. Civilian population is not directly engaged in the battle. So that's why I think we can talk about, you know, the rebellion, the coup d'etat, the all sort of things that, you know, still keep civilian population outside of the immediate harm. And as for the rest of the world, the dictators, look, the end of Putin, which I think is, by the way, it's obvious now, whatever happens in the next few hours in the vicinity of Moscow, because I could see now images now, they're preparing the defense lines, but I'm not sure that they will hold. So again, there are many, many forces just in Moscow. They again, numerical advantage is on the officially pro-government forces, but I wouldn't bet on them. But again, Prigozhin is no angel. I mean, he's on the Satan side, and it still remains to be seen what comes next. Because Russia is an empire, and Prigozhin taking over Moscow might lead to the collapse of the empire. It might lead to people in Tatarstan or elsewhere saying, wait a second, why should we follow this guy? And also Prigozhin, unlike Lenin, if we go back to 1917, has no political infrastructure to establish the rule. Whether the bureaucracy will be loyal to him, I don't know. I doubt very much. So Putin is still around. And by the way, this is this Russian internet already had few jokes, you know, paraphrasing Zelensky, I don't need the right, I need ammunition. They said, Putin said, you know, I don't need ammunition, I need the right. He already escaped, you know, he just flew. And another joke is that, you know, the war, you know, of taking Kyiv for 3 days ended up with the war of taking Moscow in 2 days.
I think I just tweeted something along those lines. All these folks who predicted Kyiv would fall within 4 days, none of them even brought up a question of whether or not Moscow might be at risk. And here we are. And you know, we should really highlight, and I think it's really important to highlight, that for everyone who believes that the U.S. and that the West is at the root of, you know, global evils, and that all of these crises, whatever, ultimately have the U.S. to blame for them, there is simply no way for anybody to look at what is happening in Russia right now and see the hand of the West, see the hand of the U.S., see the hand of...
Whoa. This is the... Of course, some of the old-fashioned Russian propaganda gurus, they already talked about British intelligence and CIA. And my comment actually on Russian internet was that I wish they were true.
It's for us to have that kind of power.
But clearly, you know, neither London nor Washington, they had any clue about what's happening there. It's a big surprise, which again, it's amazing. It's an uprising there. And you had many signs on the wall. And again, Russian history could give you a guide about the possible risks for the regime that was not doing well at a long war. And it's still, it is this, they lived under the spell of Putin's aura. You know, Putin would solve it. I mean, what the hell is Putin? I mean, he's just, you know, he's a very ordinary man. Yes, he had some animal instincts. He stayed in power for too long. But again, Ukrainian war was the first challenge that he had to deal with, where he was pushed back, really pushed back. And it didn't last long.
Clearly not. So let's take a step back. You know, we kind of jumped right into talking about what's going on. But obviously, there's a lot of background here that I think, you know, would be useful for folks to understand. And, you know, we need to start looking at that in order to see what's likely to come ahead. So obviously, we have no idea what the result will be of Prigozhin deciding that he wants to, I guess, you know, take on some element of direct political power, even though he still has refused to attack Putin directly. I mean, he's still only talking about the threats posed by those surrounding Putin rather than anything about Putin himself. You know, we already talked a little bit about what precipitated this decision by Prigozhin to attack, because Shoigu essentially threatened to take over Wagner. And, you know, Prigozhin was obviously concerned about losing his army, losing his armed forces. And meanwhile, the soldiers under him, I guess, were less afraid of marching on Moscow than they were to continue to march on Ukraine, which is obviously how Shoigu would have used them. So I guess, Gary, you've outlined all of these different elements that have gone into the standoff that we're seeing in Russia right now. Where do you see this going?
The answer is, I don't know. What we can, I believe, now agree upon is that Putin's power came to an end, because dictator can no longer function if he's not in the center of decision-making. He survives politically as a supreme power, as someone like an ultimate decision-maker who can sort out all the problems within the system. The fact is that he couldn't stop Prigozhin from this rebellion. He was silent for so many hours. He made a call that most of the troops ignore. He escaped from Moscow. He's hiding somewhere in Valdai or St. Petersburg, in one of his residences. Just demonstrated his true colors. He's a coward. He's no longer the invincible leader. So that's why, even if they succeed in taking on Prigozhin, which again I doubt, I think that Putin's days are numbered. Because now the outcome of the war in Ukraine becomes quite apparent. I don't think that demoralized Russian army can survive the Ukrainian counteroffensive. And I have, I believe, realistic expectations that Ukraine might win the war this year. Again, there's no guarantee. Russia's fortification is still there. But I don't think that Russian army now is in the position to continue war, you know, with the full energy. And Russia most likely will plunge into chaos. So how things will turn out, I don't know. I believe that there's a chance to start real reforms in Russia, because I see no way for Prigozhin to form a stable government. But what is important is for the future of Russia, it's the proactive position of the free world. It's time for America and Europe to, at this point, to come up with a plan. So what is the game plan? So how do they want to handle it? About sanctions and about the future of Russia and about Ukraine. There's so many components of this new global security infrastructure. And I wish, you know, the conversation will be open for those who had pretty good record in anticipating the events, and not only those like Samuel Chirap, these total, you know, amateurs. And not just people who work at Rand Corporation that had such a lousy record. Unfortunately, many of them still in the government making decisions. It's time to actually bring people who had a much better record in analyzing events and making predictions.
On that note, I actually want to broaden the picture a little bit. You know, there's a video, I don't know if you've seen it already, of the leader of the Kalinowski Regiment, which is a regiment of Belarusian volunteers fighting in Ukraine against Russian forces. And I should note, by the way, that the RDI delegation that Senator Heitkamp and I led in Kyiv actually met with him and met with a few of his soldiers to discuss the role of volunteers in the Ukrainian military. And he just released a video essentially calling for Belarusian civilians, you know, former military, and including the volunteers who have fought in Ukraine, to be ready for his signal, to essentially take the fight to Lukashenko, you know, to strike at a moment when the Belarusian dictator is weak. So what kind of impact do you see this having beyond Russian borders?
Look, again, it's too early to reach any conclusions, because, again, the outcome of this battle is it's a big question mark. But, again, Russia's future is at stake. If we're talking about events beyond Russia's borders, we have to also ask questions about Russian borders.
Huh. So I like that.
What will be Russian borders at the end of this chaotic period? I don't know the answer. I think the collapse of the empire is very likely. What I think it's important for the free world to learn is that the idea that you can secure liberalization of dictatorship by open trade and concessions has failed spectacularly again and again. But Putin's Russia is a reminder that the foreign policy that ignores moral values is a guaranteed failure. And I hope that, you know, there's these lessons that have been so expensive. If we look at the crimes committed by Putin's regime, from carpet bombing of Grozny to Republic of Georgia to Aleppo and to Mariupol and so on, there's a huge price has been paid for the West ignorance, naivete, and greed. So if we learn from these lessons, if we start building a new world based on our current experience, and also historical lessons, I think we have a chance to demonstrate that the world can be organized in a much more effective fashion. And we don't have to be hostages of the organizations like United Nations that have been built ages ago and no longer serve the purpose.
Gary, before I let you go, you know, there's one question that I know is on almost everybody's mind. You know, we put out a tweet from RDI asking people what questions they have for us. And, you know, this kept coming up. And, you know, I'm certain that this is on the mind of decision makers in Washington and in other Western capitals. I'm hoping that a number of them have finally realized what an incredible opportunity this is to strike a blow against authoritarianism and to give Ukrainians absolutely everything they need right now so that they can finish this and take back their country and all of the territory of their country. But the, you know, I think one of the biggest questions that's going to be on the minds of Western leaders as they're looking at this chaos unfold is, what about nuclear weapons? What's the threat? And can that threat be mitigated? How would you respond?
The threat, again, I don't want an answer because, again, this is classic, you know. You did so many mistakes. You reach, you know, the point where situation is critical. And you say, oh, now your advice is bad because situation is so precarious, perilous. So we just have to keep it as it is. No. I've been saying for years that every year, every month, every week, every day of Putin staying in power increases the risk of all these things, including nuclear weapons. Yeah. And what we need now is just to recognize that we cannot fix all the problems. This is Putin regime is a prime source of trouble. So let's see how we can deal with that. Do I guarantee you nothing will happen with Russian nukes? No, I cannot guarantee. But that's you actually put us in the situation where you have Putin's right-hand man rising against him and pushing Russia to the verge of civil war. It's on me. It's your damn policies that led to this disaster. So maybe now we just have to calm down and stop using this argument. Yeah, I know it's a problem. It might concerns me because it's my country. Yeah, and it may, you know, put the world in great danger. But as of now, we just have to go step by step. Step number one, we have to make sure Putin is out. Yeah, we'll see if Prigozhin is there. Maybe he will negotiate. I don't know. But Putin is the main problem. Putin has been using nuclear blackmail for years. And don't forget that, you know, a couple of weeks before, he began using it again. When you look at the articles of Karaganov and Trenin. So again, he's just, you know, he always looked for weakness. So that's why Putin is out and we have other people in, even if they're bad guys. There's better chance, not guaranteed, better chance they will negotiate.
Well, I think on that note, we can close out this special episode of Winter is Here. Gary, I want to thank you and I want to encourage our listeners to stay tuned because we're going to obviously be keeping a very close eye on what's going on in Russia and we're going to be continue offering updates over the coming days and weeks. We're at this unique moment in history where we have this inflection point where things can change in fundamental ways. And with any inflection point, there are huge risks, but there are also huge opportunities. And at RDI, our job is to try to help us seize those opportunities while mitigating the risks. So with that, Gary, thank you. And thank everyone for listening.
Thank you.